You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Trisica Monroe. Trisica, it's good to have you here this morning.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So the way we start is with a big question. Who are you? What do we need to know about?
That's a very big question.
I know, it's a big question. But it's what do we, you know, what about you do we need to know to start the conversation? What you value, what you live for, what you've done, some of the labels you wear. What pieces do we need to know to start?
Oh, some of the labels I wear.
Well, you can okay. You can put labels, but how. Because we need something to start the conversation. It's always awkward start. And that's why a big question allows people to find any place in the universe to go.
Okay, great. Well, I'll start with the labels one because I think that's a lot easier for me to generate in the moment spontaneously. So with apologies to Audre Lorde, I'm a Black, queer, immigrant woman, who recently became an American citizen in this very interesting time in the country. I think I can start there with some labels.
Sure.
Who am I? What am I about? I am about responsibility. I'm finding more and more the older I get, I'm realizing that I'm more and more responsible as becoming the defining word of my life.
Right, right.
And also, I think another word would be stewardship.
Right, right. And responsible is a neat word because it conveys both responding to, but also taking care of.
Yes.
And there are two different actions.
Yes, they are. They are two different actions, I think. Yeah. And I think for me, I had a realization on Friday in therapy. where I realized that for the bulk of my life, I thought, you know, I'm a responsible person. I take responsibility for what's happening around me.
Sure, sure.
I take responsibility for how my family and institutions and all of those things I care about are functioning.
You make the life you live. You help to make the life
correct.
You live.
Yeah. Exactly. And for years, I had been laboring under the misapprehension that I was gearing up to like jump into life and to like do stuff and figure stuff out.
That it was going to start somewhere down the road.
Exactly. And then with my therapist on Friday, I realized that I was already in the arena, such as it is.
Right.
And
it started a long time ago.
Yeah. But funnily enough, I was on the periphery trying to pull people out of the stands to join me and probably getting balls lobbed at my head and not realizing it.
Uh-huh.
So that was my wake-up call at the end of this week. It was very interesting.
And just to stay with that for a second, if you're willing, what does it mean to kind of get things lobbed at you while you're in the stands? Does it mean you're not stepping into the stadium?
No, I am in the stadium.
Okay.
So if you picture a soccer field, that's the sport I grew up with, and so you've got the barricade, and then it's like there are people in the lowest rows.
Right,
so pretend that I'm the person on the field, but at the barricade going, guys, come on, grab my hand. I'll pull you in. I'll pull you in. It'll be great. And folks are resistant.
And they're throwing stuff at you rather than coming to be with you.
And because there's a game happening behind me, I'm not paying attention to the plays.
I see. Yeah.
Do you see what I mean?
Yep. No,
yeah. So that was my...
You're a little clueless in the stadium.
Yes. It's like I stepped onto the field and didn't realize I'd stepped onto the field a long time ago.
And people are seeing what you're inviting them to, but you're not seeing what's going on behind you.
Correct.
That you know, this is one of the most powerful metaphors that we've ever begun the show with. there's a certain, you know, I come from white rural poverty. Mm-hmm. In the middle part of this country, and have often not. When I came to Cornell as an undergraduate, I said after my first year, there are no people here. Because they all treat me as though I were just a student, and I can only interact with them as their official role.
Yes.
There are no people. They don't share enough of their life, so I cannot assess them as persons. I come from a really strong community background, even though it was poverty, that you really people tell their stories so you can know who they are, and they can know who you are, and you know how to be responsible together when you know each other.
Yes.
But you can't if you're just carrying out a role.
Yeah.
And
that's
so,
a really nice characterization. I have a less nice characterization. But
yeah, well, you can go there too. so it resonates with me in a very powerful way.
That was my Friday.
Yeah,
still reverberating. Still need to figure out what I want to do with that information.
Right.
and even unpack it a lot more.
Right, right. Yeah. And but it sounds like you're a person who listens to the resonance of your life.
Yes, yes.
So it reverberates.
Yes.
I mean, there's a powerful language there.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's true.
So what should we go to musically to start the show?
Oh my gosh, definitely The Truth by Handsome Boy Modeling School.
Okay, here we go. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Trisica Monroe.
Hi, everybody.
So Trisica, given how given the life you live now,
okay,
what are some of the things that you had to experience to both be able to value that life and to have that session that you just described where you saw yourself kind of on the edge of the field trying to bring people in? What have you had to come to terms with to get to the point where you value the life you live now?
Oh, wow. Okay. So we're going to go right into it then.
Yeah.
Okay. So what have I had to experience to value the life I live now? Well, one of the big things that actually happened in my recent part of my life, in my mid-20s, the U.S. government tried to deport me. So I was 20, God, how old was I? I just finished college, so I was 23, I think. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if people are familiar or if you're familiar with how the immigration process works, but...
go ahead and explain. Is this sure, relevant sure. to your
so,
story?
So sure. Just like a quick thing. I had... submitted all of my paperwork to become a U.S. citizen. I'd been going through the process for forever. because it's a process that takes a really long time. And just as a context for this information, my paperwork was submitted right around 9/11. And when 9/11 happened, USCIS was a disaster, paperwork-wise. Mm-hmm. Lines were incredibly long. It was a disaster. So I have memories of being in high school, and my mom getting up at like 3 a.m. to go to the application center in Lower Manhattan to hold our spot online.
Right, right.
And she would sleep on a piece of cardboard and all kinds of crazy things. And then my brother and I would get up at 6 and go meet her there. Sure. And the line would have wrapped around several blocks by that point.
Right.
When I say disaster, disaster. So after I graduated from college, and I moved to Ithaca with my partner, now wife, I was like, oh, I'm finally in a small area. I can just have all my paperwork that's been languishing in a black hole, basically,
right,
transferred to a local field office, and I'll finally be able to move forward with my life.
Right, right.
So we moved to Ithaca. Like, we've settled in. I have a job. I have 2 jobs at this point. And I put in a notice to the field office in Buffalo going, hey, I sent you my paperwork a long time ago. Why haven't I heard anything? I went to speak to someone. They said, oh, for some reason, we put your application in cold storage. That's weird. I was like, that is weird. Showed them all of my receipts, showing that I had paid for everything. And right. She said, oh, we'll just get it pulled from storage and we'll figure it out and I'll let you know. She calls me 2 weeks later and says, hey, so we got your application. I forwarded it to the office for them to review it. So you should be hearing something soon. I was like, okay, great. I felt really positive. And then 3 days before my birthday, I get a notice from the government saying you have been ordered to appear for removal proceedings because you didn't respond to a notice from us to come in for something or other. And I went, that's just not possible.
Right, right.
I have an application number and I've been checking my application status on the web obsessively.
Right.
And at no point on the web did you tell me that you sent me a notice for any reason. You just keep telling me my paperwork is being processed and you'll contact me when there's something I need to do, right? But of course, it's the American government and they don't care that they've made a mistake that could wreck your whole life. So I end up losing one of my jobs. I end up spending thousands of dollars that I should have been using to pay back my student loans. That's another thing. And going through this whole years-long process and drama to get them to cancel my removal, which I was successful in. And so during that period of time, because I was in my mid-20s, I was like, oh, the universe is coming at me really hard right now. I should really spend this time trying to figure out like who I am and what I've been up to. So while that was all happening externally, I mm-hmm. went on this epic, I say epic, internal journey to sort of like clean up some of my stuff.
Right. I mean, it's your taking responsibility.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, oh, this is a perfect moment for me to like clean up some of my stuff from my childhood. You know, like moving to Ithaca gave me a lot of distance from a rather fraught relationship with my family at the time. Mm-hmm. My mother didn't take it very well when I came out to her. Excuse me. So it was this perfect moment in time where I was finished with being an undergrad and having that beautiful transformative experience that I think a lot of people undergo when they go to college, particularly if you're Black and queer and Caribbean and couldn't come out to your family fully when you were at home. Mm-hmm. So it was this container that I felt, okay, life comes at you fast, sure. And when that happens to me, I go internally and go, okay, so what can I clean up? What can I figure out? What can I do? And one of my best friends from college, she and I also share the same birthday, had taken up with this, what I call a woo-woo organization. I think they grew out of another thing called EST in the like 70s,
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So Landmark.
Yes. And Landmark is well known here in Ithaca.
Oh, yeah. So my friend Jenny goes, Tris, okay, this horrible thing is happening to your life. You should come do this thing. And I was like, Jenny, I am not paying money to go talk to a cult right now. Right. Like, I'm not doing that. And Jenny said, fair. I will do it. I will pay it for you. I was like, okay, fine, whatever. So Jenny pays for me to do whatever that initial day-long, possibly 2-day-long thing is.
Right.
And I went to that. And it was lovely because in the Black community, and particularly how I grew up in the Caribbean.
And that's a different community from the generally American Black community.
Yeah. And then being an immigrant in America, there's this like hunkering down, I feel like happens in my community, particularly around mental health. And there's this, it's like the thing you don't talk about.
It's a steel gate.
Yeah. Exactly. And any sort of philosophical excavation of your life is stuff you don't talk about. And when I was in college, I'd had my mind blown wide open by reading the works of James Baldwin. And so I was like, you know what? This is the... So words tend to console me and help move me in particular directions, and help me do a lot of that excavating. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to spend some time figuring myself out, because when this whole experience is over, I want to be ready to like engage with the external world again or something.
Right. At least I want to get a handle on what's going on here.
Correct. So I go do the landmark thing. It was... To be honest, it was delightful. It was really nice to have a container where I could talk about certain events in my life and talk about my response to those events, and then be able to get some psychological distance from them.
Right. Just letting them out means you no longer sit on them.
Correct. Yeah. And I'm the kind of person, I don't like to spiral. I feel very uncomfortable. So if something happens and I find myself stewing about it and I'm like just swirling, like
you got to find an anchor to stop.
Thoughts.
Yeah.
I'm just like, I just want to pull out of that space. Yeah. It's just like, I can't just swirl the drain. I don't like it. So it was really good to have that space to be with people who were also doing something similar, who were talking about things mostly negative that had happened to them, and figuring out my response to those events, and then figuring out how to get some distance from those events. And I think that was the most important thing that happened to me at that point in my life, was that I finally recognized that it was okay to not be in my stuff. I was like...
It's not a stew you have to marinate in all the time.
Exactly. And that was the most profound... I never went back to Landmark again. I think I did one follow-up thing, and then I was like, this is too much.
But did you learn to go play?
Yeah. And I learned that it was okay to be present in my life and respond to what's happening, and that I don't always have to be in conversation with stuff that had happened before. Mm-hmm. So... Yeah, that's one of the big things that drives my life currently, is that understanding that being present and responding to what's happening externally
is
kind of where I am now.
Right. And there's this huge reservoir of experience and wisdom and knowledge, and you don't have to swim in it all the time, but you can draw on it.
Yeah.
And sometimes parts of it are toxic, I imagine.
That's where
they all are, and parts of it are really rich.
But
you don't have to draw on it all the time to be with another person.
Correct.
Or be with a big crowd.
Correct.
Or to try to figure out how to be in the stadium.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, that's a different problem I need to work through, but yes.
No, but I mean, but it's all the same, knowing where you are present and how to be effective there.
Yeah.
And what do you have to pull up?
Yes.
And what do you have to kind of just ignore so you can do what needs to be done? However you figure that out.
Yeah.
So it's just a kind of a powerful moment. How many years since those mid-20s? I don't mean to...
I'm 32. It's cool.
I don't care. No. But it's so... And you just got your citizenship recently.
Yeah. That was a journey. So actually, let me back up. So I've actually been delaying. I delayed 4 years... After my immigration file was administratively closed and I became a green card holder, I've actually been able to become a citizen for a number of years, but I refused to file the paperwork.
Sure.
I have to laugh at myself about this. So I refused to do that for a really long time. And then finally, we got the president we currently have, and I was like, oh, darn, I might want to do that. And it's funny because the whole time, so what this whole experience actually taught me about America, interestingly enough, is that everything is optional. So And it made me realize that I'm currently a citizen, but I'm actually not attached to that designation.
Right.
Because I recognize that that label is something that has force if we all agree to it at a certain moment in time.
Right.
But what's beautiful about the moment, or not beautiful necessarily, but what's interesting about the moment we're living in is that it reminded me that ideas and concepts like citizen only have force if we all agree to them.
Right.
And if we all honor them. And I'm very clear, interestingly enough, that that agreement can be upended at any point in time.
Right.
So I will not be shocked.
No.
Should anything else happen.
Right. And that's external to you, but as a personal resource, it is a tool or even a weapon that you can wield when people would use other things against you.
Yeah.
And we all have to come equipped to engage in the lives we have to live.
Yeah.
And that means having some power.
Yes.
And that even if certain others don't recognize it, others will. Mm-hmm. So you need to know what its relative value is,
yes,
what its weight and what its heft and what its power is,
yeah,
and how to wield it, not like a cruel weapon, mm-hmm, but as a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah, I think that's true.
And I am an ordained minister, but I gave up standing in my particular denomination because they took a really, what I thought was a kind of a dishonest way to inclusion. They confused inclusion with middle class professionalism.
Oh, a lot of people do that.
And this was whether you were black, brown, white, or whatever.
And I come
from poverty, and that just didn't work. And the kinds of conversations we needed to have as human beings weren't allowed because, mm-hmm, the boundaries wouldn't allow it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have stepped out, but I am still engaged. And I still participate in the pension. It's a very shrewd calculus in a certain, mm-hmm, sense. And it's permitted because we respect each other. It's an act of faith to protest,
mm-hmm,
you know? And
yeah,
and I'm still a person of faith in that sense of living out of hope and trust,
mm-hmm,
and trying to figure everything we can. So I don't mean to take over, but that is, you're making me think.
Okay.
Because citizenship is like membership.
Yeah. And it comes with responsibilities.
Right.
And it's the responsibility part that very often trips people up.
Right. And so I continue to converse, and you continue to converse with, mm-hmm, people,
yeah,
that may or may not recognize that, or, mm-hmm, or in ways that are not necessarily what you want. Let's cut again to music,
sure,
and we'll pick up with other stuff. What should we go to next?
Oh, sorry. How about Ani?
Okay. Here we go. And it's called Recoil.
Yes.
Come home and my guitar has nothing to say to me. I recoil from all my friends, and then I'm in misery. Been so long since I've been here, really since I was his. Probably just need to be held. It's all day in a line of wheelchairs against a wall, inventing ways to play out time. Like a song, like a song. To all the people out there tonight who are comforting themselves, stop and ring my bell. I'm just sitting here in this die, strewn with half-written songs, taking one breath at a time. Nothing much going on. Nothing much going on. If you should happen to see my light, you can stop and ring my bell. I'm just sitting here in this die, strewn with half-written songs, taking one breath at a time, nothing much going on.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Maid of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Trisica Monroe. So, Trisica, we've been on this arc of responsibility, mm-hmm. and part of it is kind of figuring out your citizenship, your identity, your relationships with family. But what are the other dimensions that responsibility has taken you? How has your effort to practice mm-hmm. responsibility shaped your life?
Okay. So it's shaped my life in terms of I'm constantly trying to hold things together. Mm-hmm. And particularly when things are breaking, particularly when I see that something might break, and then I like lean into the fray and try to like
sure
shore up things. And it's also, and right now in our current political moment that we're living through, right now, it's meant for me, trying to figure out new ways to be responsible, because before, so before this current administration, you know, I've been involved in my local community. I've worked with Big Brother, Big Sister. I'm on the board at Green Star. And so I'm on the board of Green Star currently, and I joined the board because I like food security is a big thing for me. Mm-hmm. Supporting local businesses is a huge thing for me. And so joining a local institution like Green Star was something I was really excited to do for those reasons, and because I feel a strong need to participate in some of my mm-hmm, local mm-hmm. institutions. And there's a thing that I just thought of. Hold on, let me see if I can recapture it. But I'll keep talking. And so for me, that prior to this current administration, my responsibility, the way I've been responsive is about being involved as much as I possibly could.
And sounds locally.
In Ithaca. Yeah, because one of the things I will say as an immigrant to the United States that appalls me is how much so many of our communities are the same. So, and I this was clarified for me on a trip actually to go to a funeral in Massachusetts several years ago. One of my wife's uncles passed away, and he lived in Massachusetts, and we all bundled into the car and we carpooled and we went to the funeral, and we were on the highway the whole way, and we stayed at a random chain mm-hmm. motel. And that night after the service, the night before the service, I had this horrible nightmare that the world had ended and that nobody knew that the world had ended because every place looked the same. And so you thought you were going to different places, but you encountered the same people. Right. And, you know, like everywhere you go, it feels like you can find a Starbucks, a McDonald's, or whatever.
Right.
And I find that actually really depressing. Yep. And so I'm a big... I really need local flavor mm-hmm. and local color. I want to go to a place and go, ah, this is what this place is like. I've been to a few cities and I'm like, ah, generic North American city. Okay. Okay. What makes this place special?
Right.
And so I'm really interested in hopefully like doing something with like helping people realize that places need to feel like they need to have a character that's visible too on the landscape instead of this like sea of the same kind of buildings.
Right, right.
The same kind of business, the exact same businesses because frequently they're a franchise of something.
Right, 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 right.
Ugh.
Yeah, and I guess this is interesting because I've never really had the occasion to talk about this topic in quite the way you've just raised it, but I want to suggest, you know, I grew up in lily white Gentry County, Missouri. Mm-hmm. Funny name, Gentry, since we were lost 75-80% of its population over the course of the 20th century, and still has even more extremes now of poverty and affluence between those who control and own a fair amount of capital, land, and whatnot, mm-hmm. and those who have very little and are generally either very old or very young. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the point of this is there was a time when that kind of generic white community actually, you didn't necessarily notice all of the businesses that were like any other businesses in small towns. They weren't owned by chains, but you know, there was a certain kind of predictability to them. But in really small, intimate culture, people are characters, mm-hmm. and they carve out space. Mm-hmm. for themselves. So, you know, we had a woman who was the postmistress, and I've talked about her often, in 1915, and she was the mayor in 1930, and, you know, a quarter to a third of the members of the Chamber of Commerce in 1900 were women. Mm. And we don't think about this in our history, but there were lots of strong characters, and there were farmers who were pro-cooperatives, mm-hmm. and there were farmers who were anti-cooperatives because the cooperatives might dump milk or they might slaughter animals and bury them to try to raise the prices. And there were farmers, they were against those practices because it was destroying food, even in the name of trying to raise wages for farmers. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of moral complexity, mm-hmm. and people would try to live lives that were kind of different. There was one man whose wife died when he was maybe about 60 or late 50s, and he was in such intense grief, and they had listened to the opera together on the radio on Saturdays. This was back in the 1960s or early 70s, and he learned how to fly a plane. He had enough money that he could do that. He also drove a front-wheel Toronado, you know, the only American-made front-wheel. He was a quirky guy, but he flew from Northwest Missouri to New York to see each of the Metropolitan Opera shows in person and to sit with the presence of his wife, who couldn't do that. And nobody in King City. I mean, because people believed that they could make their lives. They had a responsibility for taking care of their own grief. And what you're talking about is how can we make the difference here? How can we get past the generic Starbucks or the whatever? And part of it's by being people who are accessible to each other. And we don't have to try to be quirky because we are all quirky if we get to know each other in any sorts of particulars. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think that's true.
And it's something that doesn't require a lot of capital because it's just, mm-hmm. but it requires some ways of interacting with each other, how to be responsive to each other and mm-hmm. responsible. So I'm trying to push you on the responsibility piece and how can you address this without having to rebuild the infrastructure or to go on the attack of the infrastructure, but rather to go on the invitation mm-hmm. to the people.
Oh, huh.
The people who may be silent or who may be asleep to this.
Wait, can you repeat that one more time?
Okay. How can we see the diversity and the richness that is already with us, mm-hmm. even when some of the generic stores or the generic types of things that we're engaged in just seem like so much buying into a system? Uh-huh. How can we engage each other in a way that draws out our humanity and the uniqueness of each person and place?
Okay. I think that's definitely about community and about what types of things bring a community together. And when communities show up for each other, I think there's that.
Right.
And I also think, if I'm hearing you correctly, I think that... So one clarifying thing. I guess I'm not attacking the architecture.
No.
I feel like there needs to be... I think it's also true that you know the culture of a place regardless of what the buildings look like. Mm-hmm. So I just want to say that.
Yeah.
I think you figure that out pretty quickly, and you figure out whether a place is for you or not.
Right. Or yeah, whether it supports you or whether it holds you away or pushes you out.
Yeah. And I think people get a sense of it pretty immediately in terms of how they interact with people when they go to the various local institutions, whether that's a store, whether that's a park, whether that's whatever, where you work, for example. So I think it becomes really apparent very quickly what a place is about, mm-hmm. based on the accumulated, I don't know, energy of the people who've been there for a while.
It's and how they interact with each other in ways that they're not even conscious of.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's true. And I think how do we see the diversity in each other? I think that was part of it.
Yeah, there are two questions here. How do we draw out what's already there? And how do we create rituals for meeting each other that allow us to talk more openly than we might?
Okay.
You know, because a lot of our interactions are pro forma, you know, and we don't really see each other.
Yeah, I think one of the things there is about figuring out who's not participating. It's like we, for example, take Ithaca. We're a small city. And it's like, you know, you have events. You're like, who's showing up to stuff? Mm-hmm, who's not showing up to stuff? If you own, whether or not you rent or not, who's in my neighborhood? Mm-hmm. Who lives here? Like, who are the people who spend their days around me that I might not engage with? And do I talk to them? Mm-hmm. Do I know a little bit about their lives? I think things like that. I think figuring out who isn't present, who isn't visible, who doesn't... whose voice isn't being heard? I think thinking about all of those things. I feel like here in Ithaca, we're rapidly becoming two Ithacas, an Ithaca that's very, very wealthy and an Ithaca that's very, very poor.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, you know, figuring out how to bridge those gaps, how to have a city that can support people at various ends of the economic, or at various points of the economic spectrum, I think is an important thing to talk about and think about. And I think a lot of that involves dialogue and also meeting people where they are, going, so if people aren't showing up to something, like going to where people are and figuring out what's happening there, I think is a good thing to do.
Yeah, and I guess what I'm, and maybe this is When you, we can't organize community. If it's organized, it's really not a community. And if it's a community, it's not organized, because the community happens. Mm-hmm. And it's what people give themselves to freely without being told, this is how you should do it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so the question for me comes, how do we invite people to connect across these boundaries of, and I think economic class is the biggest issue that's forcing us into two Ithacas. My doctoral work is in community economic development, and I saw 20 years ago that we were already 10 or 20 years ahead of the country in terms of dividing along economic class lines, and it's just gotten worse over the last 25 years.
Yeah.
And so for me, given my predilection to faith, how do I become the kind of person that can welcome another person into a conversation and not put them off? How can I respond to the fact that they're present, but they may not know how to speak to me, or even make eye contact with me, or even if that's appropriate? How do we figure out, how do we do this dance of being in each other's presence in a way that we can be just slightly more personal, slightly more community than we might have been otherwise, without making it a big formal organized push that people get reactive about?
I think for me, what I'm hearing, so how I move about the world is always about meeting people wherever they are. So for example, when I met you this morning, we'd never met before, I don't think. So for me, what's really important to me is not about, I have no preconceived notions about who you are and what you're up to.
Right.
And so we can have a conversation where I'm not bringing anything. And I guess what it's bringing up for me right now is about presence. It's like, are you being present when you meet someone, whoever that someone is?
Right.
Whether that someone is the poop, or whether that's someone random you run into on the street.
Or is going through your recycling to take any bottles or cans that they can redeem.
Yeah, it's like, be present.
Yeah.
Be, and not bring preconceived notions to interactions with folks.
Or if you can't do that, to not allow them to get in the way of your reaching. Yeah. I mean, it's a slightly different emphasis. Sometimes we can't let go of it because the assumptions hit us really quickly.
Uh-huh.
But we can at least override them.
And I think at minimum, if you treat people with courtesy and with dignity mm-hmm. and respect,
they come back to you.
That's I think that's just basic mm-hmm. dignity, respect, basic yeah. Stuff. I think in terms of our interpersonal interactions, and I think that you can also create. While you can't force people to be in community, I think that we are all here. We kind of have to be in community.
It would be hard not to do it, but we have institutions uh-huh. that organize in ways that keep us separate or keep us from actually.
Yeah.
Because, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Everyone finds their own tribe and they yeah. like yeah. Mm, yeah. glom yeah. onto yeah. each other. Yeah. No, yeah. that's real. Yeah. I think the trick and the challenge is to have. For where we are right now in this point in time, it's like you can have your tribal relationships, whatever they are, or institutions, whatever they are, and also still cooperate mm-hmm. across them. I think that's more important. I think we need to figure out how to be different and also still work together. Like right. that's the trick.
Right. And to have the notion of kind of organized institutional identity, loyalty, tribal loyalties, but also to know that I can interact in a way which lets all of those assumptions go with somebody who doesn't share them.
Yeah.
That I don't have to be accountable to those when I'm with somebody who's different.
Or not even just like accountable, but it doesn't have to be fraught.
Right. Yes. Yeah. yes, you yeah. said it. Yeah, far better.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be fraught. It doesn't have to be I can't talk to you because X, or I can't be in relationship with you because I have this faith and you have this other faith or something like that.
Right. Or you tell me, or you open the show with, you know, that you know, I am a Caribbean
Black woman, queer feminist, black queer Caribbean feminist. Woman.
Yeah, yeah. And to me, you are singing the story of your life in a simplistic way.
Yeah.
It's simplistic, but it's a declaration. And I don't have to take it as a declaration of war. I take it as a declaration of identity and wholeness and yeah. value and something that you not only wear, but you aspire to figuring out what it means.
Yeah. Or it's like me... It's really funny because, so here, I'll try to approximate what I'm thinking by sharing a story. So I tend to get into trouble with people who are close to me because, I find myself having to say to people that I'm friends with or that I'm acquainted with that I have strong opinions, they're very lightly held. And I have to say that because I feel like in this country, in this culture, there's this thing about if I say something declaratively, it must mean that it prohibits any other statement from happening. And so I find myself going, if you ask me something, I will respond, but that is not the end of it.
Right.
We can have right. a conversation right. about what I've just said. I'm just telling you where I stand right now.
Right.
It does not mean that I can't move, won't move, cannot be moved, or anything like right.
and
that.
And it doesn't mean that I expect you to take on what I value.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Exactly. It's and like, for me, I'm like lobbing. You lobbed me a ball, I lobbed it right back.
Right, right. And this is... In cultures where visiting is the primary way of communicating, people make bold statements to each other in these visiting context, conversational. And they hear and they throw it back and they yeah. hear back.
But there's this weird kind of, and this is what I mean about getting into the arena, I think, going back to sure, that statement. Sure. There's this weird sort of inhibition that I encounter a lot in the people I know and love where there's this like, I don't want to dance with you. And I'm like, okay, but can we just like stay on the same floor? Can we,
right.
Can we agree to be in, it's like communion in a way. It's weird.
Well,
I'm not sure what I'm trying to approximate, but there's this hesitancy. There's this, so I say something, someone will ask me, what do you think about doing such and such? And I'll go, I don't really want to do that.
Right.
Because that's my,
right.
And
it's not a judgment against their doing it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But so often I find myself in conversation where I say, oh, I don't want to do that, or I want to do this.
Right.
And the other person responds to it as being shut down or that I've insulted them. And I go, wait a minute. Like, step into life.
Right.
And tell me what you're thinking and tell me what you're feeling and tell me what your opinions are.
Right.
And
right.
we can talk about it. But just because I declare something, it doesn't mean that you can no longer take up space.
Right, right, right. And there's a, this is very interesting. I too tend to be a person who can speak very forcefully. And if you understand that I am just trying my hardest to dance with my whole soul. Mm-hmm. And if you want to dance with me, we're going to end up in a huge sweat when it's over with, and we may have covered the dance floor or whatever, but you know, if that's where I am dancing. Now I can dance slow and tender and whatever, and that may be for another person or another time or another whatever, but we have this engagement. And there's nothing to be ashamed of.
Yeah, exactly.
As a cult, and what this avoidance of the force of our declarative selves means is we cannot be strong women or men in each other's presence.
Exactly.
We have to be weak, or we have to be halfway there.
Yeah, it's timid.
We cannot afford to be timid in the times we live.
Exactly, exactly. It's like so many people, so timid, and it drives me bananas because it, to be perfectly honest, it adds to my work because then I have to say things like, no, I need you to tell me what it is you actually need.
And why do I need, because you're not, you
because
don't need
I don't
to be,
have time.
Right? And you don't need to be dependent upon me.
Yeah.
I need you to be independent so we can be stronger together.
Yes. And I need to be able to trust you to respond to me with what you're genuinely feeling in the moment and what your genuine needs are.
Right. Even if we
so get, that I don't have to guess. I never want to have to guess.
Right.
I'm not psychic. I don't want to be.
Right. And if you are going to hurt me or if I'm going to hurt you, it's going to be clean and it's going to be relatively upfront. And the pain and the grief and the suffering that we will openly bear is openly born.
Exactly.
And not hidden.
Exactly. So much is hidden. It drives me bananas. Yeah.
I want to cut to music, and then we're going to come back to the final segment of the
sure.
show. What should we play next?
How about, you know what? Let's just break the Beyoncé eyes.
Sure, sure. Here we go. This is Sorry, and this is a very powerful song.
So what are you going to say at my funeral now that you've killed me? Here lies the body of the love of my life, whose heart I broke without a gun to my head. Here lies the mother of my children, both living and dead. Rest in peace, my true love, who I took for granted. Most bomb pussy, who because of me sleep evaded. Her shroud is loneliness. Her God was listening. Her heaven will be a love without betrayal. Ashes to ashes, dust to side chicks.
I ain't thinking about you. I ain't thinking about you. watch, you should have been home. Today I regret the night I put that ring on. He always got them fucking excuses. I pray to Lord you reveal what his truth is. I left a note in the hallway. By the time you read it, I'll be far away. I'm far away, but I ain't fucking with nobody. Let's have a toast to the good life. Suicide before you see this tear fall down my eyes. Me and my baby, we gon' be alright. We gon' live a good life. Big homie better grow up.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Trisica Monroe.
Hello.
Yes, Trisica. This has been great fun, but now we're gonna quit being topical in terms of that what we've been talking about, and we're gonna switch. What do you do to take care of yourself?
What do I do to take care of myself?
Emotionally, intellectually, physically, throughout the day, daily, weekly, monthly.
Ecumenically. Okay.
Yeah. I'm basically, okay. You know, and for a lot of people it takes them a while to learn that it's their responsibility, like mm-hmm. you're going deep in your 20s. Mm-hmm. Self-care is our kind of number one issue. If we don't take care of ourselves, mm-hmm. we're not going to be there for others, and we're not going to be very clear.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, absolutely. So how did you learn to do it, and what do you do?
So what I do, I meditate, not as often as I really should, but I do meditate. I occasionally go to the gym. But the biggest thing I do for myself in terms of my emotional, mental health care, besides going to therapy, is I have one particular bestie in town. She and I do a lot of deep work together, I guess mm-hmm. you could call
sure,
it.
Sure.
So we are always, we have what we call commuting times, and we get together, we talk about what's going on in our lives, we talk about some philosophical idea that we've encountered. We engage in what I like to call the big questions. And that I find really rejuvenating and really good for my spirit.
Sure.
So that's a thing that I do to take care of myself. I'm constantly interrogating myself, I guess, to excavate areas that are hidden to me and bring them into my awareness. So mm-hmm. like the conversation mm-hmm. I had on Friday with my therapist that led to my realization about pulling people into the stands,
sure.
thinking I was outside of the stands and realizing I was actually in on the field pulling people in, and that was a bad plan. So I like doing that kind of work, and the more I do that kind of work, the faster my realizations come.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so it's like I discover something new and I incorporate it, and then it's like I discover something else that's new and I incorporate that, and I feel like I'm on this journey of ever knowing myself better.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's a little bit of spiritual warrior kind of quality to it.
Yeah.
And so how do you expect, and this may not be where you are in life, because at your age, but where is peace?
Where is peace?
Yeah. Where does silence? I mean, you say meditation as though you are kind of guilting yourself a little bit on not doing it enough, but where is kind of just, aha, just enough.
Just
being.
Do you mean physically?
I mean, in all of these ways, how do you just shut down to just experience the universe and to not be responsible for it? I guess what I'm asking you, this has all been about responsibility, but now how does Trisica do, I'm just here?
So the way I do that, I actually have to be completely alone.
Uh-huh. Which doesn't surprise me because you're very responsive.
I have to be completely alone, which is very difficult because I have a 17-month-old who's going on 45. And it's really hard to find a moment where I'm absolutely, completely alone.
Sure.
But when I can find the time to be alone, one of the things I like to do actually is there's this great retreat center out in Spencer called Spencer Van Etten.
It's in Van Etten, and it's Light on the Hill. Yeah.
So I do like to be at, rent the cabin for the weekend and just be by myself or be with my bestie. And for me, the best thing is if I can just be alone with my own thoughts and just to like sit very quietly, like that's perfection.
Yeah. So how do you know that you need to take care of yourself? What happens? What begins to kind of not be so good, that you know you need to step in.
Mm-hmm. So it becomes really clear when I start like spiraling. If I ever become paranoid,
right?
If I ever find myself in a situation where I'm triple thinking about what someone said and what it meant,
so repetitive thoughts or thoughts of the world being against you,
correct? Yeah. It's like that's very muddled. I'm like, this is not how I exist on a day to day basis. Got to stop that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that's usually how I know that something is wrong and I need to take care of myself and I need to retreat to some solitude,
right?
And to just like check back in with myself and come back in a way.
Yeah. No, that's a very beautiful and elegant answer. When did you realize, was your going deep in your 20s, was that when you realized you needed to take care of yourself? Or was that before?
I'd known it before, but I hadn't had space or I guess a container in which to do it. So I didn't know.
Or a structure to describe what you were doing.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So I went to a religious school as an undergrad. So, you know, I went to church services and things like that. But it wasn't for me.
Right.
And I desperately needed a non-theological space in which to talk about things that bothered me.
Sure.
And a non-theological way to think about what I was going through and what my experience of life had been. And also, I needed a non-theological way in which to, like, get over myself, to be perfectly frank.
Yeah.
Because, so all of the, all the realizations I've had to date, one of the biggest ones has been, I'm living my one life and I'm responsible for it. Absolutely. But not everything is about me. Not everything someone says is in relation to anything that has anything to do with me.
Right. You have to get out of the center of the universe.
Exactly. So like figuring out my boundaries,
right,
like my very, like my physical, mental, emotional, spiritual boundaries.
Sure.
Like that's been a beautiful thing for me. It's like, oh, I am another person going through the world and there are other people going through the world too. And I'm actually not the center of their lives.
Right.
Yeah.
And that allow, I mean, what you've described the experience of what I would call religious idolatry,
mm-hmm,
by making kind of one narrative so central that it becomes idolatrous and you don't see the others. But you can have that conversation within a religious framework, but it has to be a self-critical one.
Yes.
And if it's not, then it's not possible.
Mm-hmm.
Triska, it has been wonderful to get to know you.
Oh, thank you for this opportunity. It's been great.
What should we close with?
Oh, my gosh. Oh, there are two things, but sure. Okay. You know what? I think let's do the oh, hellos. I have made mistakes. I think that makes the most sense.
Okay.
Yeah.
Here we go. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have made mistakes. I have made mistakes. I continue to make them. The promises I've made. The promises I've made. I continue to break them. And all the doubts I've faced. All the doubts I've faced, I continue to face them. But nothing is a waste. Nothing is a waste if you learn from it. And the sun, it does not cause us. The sun, it does not cause us to grow. It is the rain that will strengthen, the rain that will strengthen your soul. It will make you whole. Lived in fear. We have lived in fear.
are not alone. We are not alone in the dark with our demons. We have made mistakes. We have made mistakes. We've learned from. The sun does not cause us to grow. It is the rain that will strengthen, the rain that will strengthen your soul.